No issue is more important in U.S. foreign policy today and for the national security of this country than the threat posed by al-Qaeda. This is the only foreign enemy that has attacked the mainland of the United States since 1814, when the British burned our capital.
Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. Our guest today is Bruce Riedel. Bruce Riedel, who retired in 2006 after 30 years as a CIA officer, is the Senior Fellow for Political Transitions in the Middle East and South Asia at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Bruce Riedel was born in New York. He's the son of a political advisor at the United Nations. And because of that, he had the opportunity to be raised in various places around the world, Jerusalem, Beirut, Naples. Riedel was educated at Brown University and did his graduate work at Harvard. He has served as Special Assistant to the President, Senior Director for Near East and North African Affairs on the National Security Council. He was actually in the Situation Room with Condoleezza Rice during the 9/11 attacks. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense. He's been on the National Intelligence Council and has had what his resume describes vaguely as, quote, various assignments for the Central Intelligence Agency. His service has been recognized by the Department of State's Meritorious Honor Award, the Distinguished Intelligence Medal, the Secretary of Defense Distinguished Service Medal, and the Intelligence Medal of Merit. At the request of President Obama, he recently chaired an interagency review of policy towards Afghanistan and Pakistan for the White House that was completed in March of this year. Recently, he's published The Search for Al-Qaeda, Its Leadership, Ideology, and Future, and he is the co-author of a fascinating paper, which I hope we have time to discuss some today, Which Path to Persia? Options for a New American Strategy Toward Iran. Please welcome Bruce Riedel.
Thank you.
Thank you for that very kind introduction. Thank you for coming out today. We're going to be spending a considerable amount of time talking about the situation in South Asia, and I'm glad to say that the Lord has provided the appropriate weather, a monsoon, in order to provide the ambiance for talking about South Asia. No issue is more important in U.S. foreign policy today and for the national security of this country than the threat posed by al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda today remains a deadly adversary of the United States of America. This is the only foreign enemy that has attacked the mainland of the United States since 1814, when the British burned our capital. The attack of September 11th killed almost 3,000 Americans and cost this country economic damage, which we are still recovering from. More than that, it led directly to one foreign war and indirectly to another, and we remain in both of those wars. Al-Qaeda is also the world's first truly global terrorist organization. It has achieved a global status that no other terrorist organization has ever achieved before. From a headquarters believed to be, and almost certainly is, somewhere in Pakistan today, it has franchises throughout most of the Islamic world, in Yemen, in Iraq, in North Africa, in Somalia, in Indonesia. It has supporters and underground cells throughout much of the Muslim diaspora in the West, particularly in Western Europe, and especially in Great Britain. And it has many followers and sympathizers in an even broader network than that. And yet, there is a tremendous amount of misinformation about al-Qaeda on both sides. Many Americans, for a very, very long time, for example, believed that Saddam Hussein and Iraq somehow were associated with al-Qaeda and that were somehow involved in the attack of September 11th. That misinformation lasted far beyond the point at which all available evidence had discredited that story. On the other hand, many Muslims for a long time, and many Muslims today still are in denial about what happened on September 11th. The pernicious myth that the attack of September 11th was really the work of the Mossad continues to be believed by a sizable number of peoples in the Islamic world. This one's even harder to understand. Al-Qaeda proudly proclaims responsibility for September 11th. Every September 11th, they have a major media show to underscore their responsibility. And yet, denial and misinformation remains rampant. What I've tried to do in this book, in a crisp narrative, I hope, is give information to put these misinformation to rest, to fill, if you want, the knowledge gap about al-Qaeda. I deliberately tried to keep it short so that people would read it. If you're like me, when I see 450 pages on the library shelf, I usually say, well, maybe next summer. This is intended to be a book that you can read in one weekend. The mechanism to explain the story of al-Qaeda is relatively simple. It's to look at the biographies of four key figures in al-Qaeda, beginning with Ayman Zawahiri. Ayman Zawahiri is an Egyptian doctor. He has been on the run now, literally, since 1980, when he was a minor participant in the plot to murder President Anwar Sadat. He has roamed across the Islamic world. He's even been to the United States at one point during those years to raise funds. He is the ideologue of al-Qaeda. If there is someone who is the brains behind this organization in terms of developing their ideology and telling their narrative, it is Ayman Zawahiri. Secondly, of course, Osama bin Laden, the charismatic leader of al-Qaeda. He is referred to by his followers as the Knight. In their ideology, they see themselves as glorious knights fighting a much larger enemy. This man is also remarkable in many ways. He is the son of one of the richest people in the world. He comes from a Saudi family that made a fortune in building the infrastructure of the modern Saudi state, including building the roads that connect it, the airports that make it part of the international transportation network, and of course, the two holy mosques, which make it the centerpiece of the Islamic world. His mother was Syrian, so he spent a good part of his childhood living in Lebanon and Syria. His father not only built the two holy mosques in Medina and Mecca, but he was also very much involved in the reconstruction an expansion of the Holy Mosque in Jerusalem, which until 1967 was, of course, in Jordan. And Osama bin Laden probably lived, or at least visited, Jerusalem during his childhood. He became a hero in the Islamic world, fighting against the Soviets in Afghanistan in the 1980s, very much the most transformative episode in his life. The third figure, I'll use only his alias, Abu Musaib al-Zarqawi, because that's the name by which he's known, is thankfully no longer with us. This is the man who set the trap for the United States in many ways, in Iraq. He is the evil genius behind al-Qaeda's franchise in Iraq. This is a man who is so violent during his life that even his own supporters referred to him as the stranger, because they found it hard to believe that the depths of violence that he was willing to pursue. Even the leadership of al-Qaeda had doubts about the wisdom of some of the tactics, like cutting off heads, that he pursued. His legacy in Iraq was almost civil war. He kept the country as close to civil war as he possibly could have. The last figure is not really a member of al-Qaeda, but the leader of al-Qaeda's partner in crime, if you like, the Afghan Taliban. This is Mullah Omar. If the other three figures are reasonably well known in the outside world, Mullah Omar is a much more difficult figure to find anything about. This is a man who is so fundamentalist and extreme in his views that he doesn't meet with Christians. He won't meet with unbelievers. He has probably met in his life with non-Muslims less than a half dozen times. Unlike the other three, he's not a very vocal individual either. He doesn't say a lot. We don't hear from him very often. But he has been the leader of the Taliban since its creation in the mid-1990s, and today he is the leader of the war against American and NATO forces in Afghanistan, and he very much is in charge. In the hierarchy of al-Qaeda, in fact, he comes above Osama bin Laden. Osama bin Laden has sworn his loyalty to Mullah Omar. He can be a remarkably charismatic individual. At one point early in his career, he went into a mosque in Kandahar and took there a relic, a cloak, which was said to be the cloak of the Prophet Muhammad, and put it on in front of the crowd, in effect saying, "I am the heir to the Prophet Muhammad." That's a man who has delusions of grandeur, to put it mildly. You're probably asking, what are the sources for this book? Obviously, I haven't interviewed any of these individuals, nor am I likely to. And if I did, I probably wouldn't be able to come back to tell you about it. I have interviewed an awful lot of people who have met them, though, including the head of Saudi intelligence, who met Osama bin Laden often in the 1980s, Pakistanis who've met with them in the 1990s, the head of Jordanian intelligence, who almost killed Zarqawi and wishes that he hadn't missed the chance in retrospect back in 1989. But the principal source is their own words. With the exception of Mullah Omar, these are not bashful people. They like to talk. They like to put out their message. Ayman Zawahiri in particular is almost a chatty Cathy of the jihadist world. He writes books. I wouldn't recommend them. They're deadly. They are very obscure in many ways. You have to be almost inside the jihadist movement to understand what he's talking about many times. But he gives speeches and audio messages and video messages that come out very, very frequently. He averages a new message about once every other week. He was actually at a faster pace for a while, but he seems to have slowed down recently. He just put out a message a week ago about the president's trip to Cairo. He's even done the virtual equivalent of call-in shows, where you could write on the internet a question and that he would answer it in a video later on. Bin Laden is a little bit more bashful. You don't hear him quite as often. But he also just put out a new video message just a week ago talking about the struggle in Pakistan. Let me briefly give you some of the key conclusions of the book, and I'll highlight four in particular. First, the Arab-Israeli conflict is central, pivotal to the narrative and ideology of al-Qaeda. Let me give you the short version of what they think they're doing and what this war with them is all about. Again, this is from their standpoint. Al-Qaeda argues that the Western world, the Crusaders and Zionists, that's you, have been rapaciously attacking the Islamic world for roughly the last two centuries with a considerable degree of success. That our goal, the West, the Crusaders, is to divide and conquer the Islamic world. In other words, to split it up into small states which we can manipulate, which we can put our supporters, our puppets, on the thrones and presidencies of the Islamic world to do our bidding. The purpose, of course, is to exploit the resources of the Islamic world, first and foremost, of course, their oil. Israel is a critical player in this strategy, the jihadists claim, because Israel is the advanced position of the imperialist crusaders. Situated in the heartland of the Islamic world, its job is to be the policeman to enforce law and order on behalf of the crusaders. And it has a special role, Al-Qaeda argues, in preventing any Islamic state from acquiring nuclear weapons, because an Islamic world with nuclear weapons would not be at the mercy anymore of the crusaders and Zionists. And thus, Israel's special responsibility is to prevent Islamic countries from acquiring nuclear weapons. That's the argument. It's an argument which comes naturally to these individuals. Look at their life history. Zawahiri, it's simple. Zawahiri, as I said before, began his position in the jihad participating in the assassination of Anwar Sadat. Why was Anwar Sadat killed? Because he was making peace with Israel. And Al-Qaeda is fundamentally opposed to any peace with Israel. Its vision of the right outcome is not peace, not fair, not lasting, not justice, but destruction, the complete and utter destruction of Israel. Bin Laden, it's a little more obscure, but as I've already indicated, he grew up very much in the arena of the Arab-Israeli conflict. And the key that converted him from being a critic of his own country, a critic of the House of Saud and Saudi Arabia, to being a violent opponent of it, was ironically Saudi Arabia's somewhat tepid endorsement in the 1990s of the Oslo peace process. It's in his words again. You go back and read the record of his statements, it's the endorsement of the Oslo peace process in which he says, that's it. It was bad enough that the House of Saud was corrupt, giving away our precious resources at prices under what they should be to the crusaders. But when you're willing to make peace with the Israelis, then we're at war. Let me read you something he said just a year ago that I think makes it abundantly clear. This was on the 60th anniversary of the creation of Israel. He had this message: the main root of the conflict between our civilization and your civilization is the Palestine question. I stress that the Palestine question is my nation's central issue. It was therefore a key factor that has since childhood provided me and the free 19 men, that's a reference to the 9/11 hijackers, with an overwhelming feeling of the need to punish the Jews and those supporting him. That is why the incident of September 11th took place. Pretty clear. Why does this matter? It matters because if you want to fight the narrative, if you want to fight the ideology, you have to address its core appeal head on with the counterargument. And let me come back to that. The second key point is that the country that matters most to Al-Qaeda is Pakistan. Pakistan today is very much the epicenter of the global Islamic jihadist struggle. In many ways, we can oversimplify the last 8 years of our struggle against Al-Qaeda into one sentence. It is an oversimplification, but it is fundamentally true. In 8 years, we have succeeded in moving the core leadership and the propaganda infrastructure of Al-Qaeda from Kandahar, Afghanistan, to a location unknown, believed to be somewhere in Pakistan. And as I've already indicated, from that location in Pakistan, they continue to plot against us. Why Pakistan? Because Pakistan is the strategic prize in many ways of the Islamic world. It is the second largest Muslim country in the world. It has the seventh largest army in the world. It is where all the issues of terrorism, nuclear proliferation, nuclear peace, nuclear war come together in an extraordinarily combustible way. And most importantly, from Al-Qaeda's perspective, it has the fastest growing nuclear arsenal in the world. And it's vulnerable. And along the way, Al-Qaeda hopes to hijack that opportunity and turn Pakistan into a jihadist state. Third, Al-Qaeda's strategy. Al-Qaeda's strategy is also in what they say. It's what they call the bleeding wars. They want us to invade countries in the Islamic world, get bogged down in quagmires, and bleed to death. Why? Because that's what they think they did to the Soviet Union in the 1980s. And you know, in fact, that is what they did to the Soviet Union in the 1980s. It worked then. From their standpoint, it's working quite well today. The bleeding wars are the centerpiece of Al-Qaeda's strategy, not the attacks into the West, which they refer to as raids. 9/11 in Al-Qaeda's vocabulary is the Manhattan raid. July 7th, 2005 was the London raid. We've also had the Madrid raid. Those are tactics. They're not strategy. They're designed to provoke us to moving in. From their standpoint, they think they're doing great. Another Osama bin Laden tape in 2007. He talked about the home mortgage balloon in the United States. And he said Al-Qaeda was succeeding in bleeding the American economy. The Wall Street Journal had a field day with this one. They said, bin Laden, global terrorist, now thinks he knows something about the American mortgage industry. This is a joke. It's not so funny anymore. He's not right, but he's got a good soundbite. The fourth observation, though, I would make about Al-Qaeda in the book is this. It has serious fundamental weaknesses. First of all, it really does not have a program. Al-Qaeda is all about being against something. There's no positive program. There's nowhere in Al-Qaeda's literature an outline of what it is they want to build, except in the most vague way, to restore a caliphate. There's nothing about who should run it. There's nothing about what it should do on a day-to-day basis. There's nothing about how it should interact with the rest of the world. The only model Al-Qaeda holds up of what it wants for the future is the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan of the Taliban days. And that's not a very attractive role model, and certainly not for us, and certainly not for the vast majority of Muslims who do not want to live in a medieval hell. So it has serious weaknesses. Its appeal is very much to a small minority of Muslims, but obviously a small minority which is willing to conduct unbelievable acts of terror on behalf of it. Let me conclude with a few observations on where we are now and what we have begun embarking on under the new administration. I'm not here to sell you Barack Obama. I worked for him. I'm proud that I worked for him. I'm not his spokesman. But I do think that there are some important things to say about how he has refocused the war against Al-Qaeda. First, the battle of ideas has finally been joined. We are now engaged in the ideological struggle against Al-Qaeda in a way we really weren't for 7 years. We are going directly against their narrative. The president began doing this almost from the day he was inaugurated, but he certainly did it when he gave that speech in Cairo a few weeks ago. Recall how that speech began. He said, "We are not an imperialist country. You are wrong, Al-Qaeda. We are not Imperial France and the Imperial United Kingdom. We are not trying to impose a new version of the Sykes-Picot Agreement on you. We are a revolutionary power." He began by saying, "We fought against colonialism." And then, of course, he went on to attack many of the other positions of Al-Qaeda. Secondly, I think we're focusing on the right priority. I think Pakistan and Afghanistan is rightly regarded as the epicenter of the struggle, and that we need to resource the struggle there correctly, and we need to fight there smartly, which is to say, not to get bogged down in a quagmire, and at the same time, get out of Iraq in a prudent and commonsensical way. The hardest part of this is going to be trying to get Pakistan in the right direction. Pakistan requires virtual strategic change in its outlook and its national security strategy. And getting that is the hardest part of what we need to do against al-Qaeda, because Pakistan is in many ways both a patron of terror and a victim of terror. The victim is pretty obvious these days. Last year, there were 1,800 incidents of terrorism in Pakistan, including the murder, of course, of Mrs. Bhutto. But the patronage is equally important. After all, this is where al-Qaeda operates today. This is also where the headquarters of the Taliban operates today. And we know exactly where that is. It's in Quetta in Baluchistan province. Thirdly, we've gotten back into the business of trying to promote peace in the Middle East. The Bush administration disastrously turned its back on that for reasons which were understandable, which I'm well aware of. The effort to make peace at Camp David collapsed in 2000. It was understandable that a new administration looking at that would say, we don't want that. Enough of this. But even the Bush administration realized by the end of about 6.5 years that that was a mistake and that you had to get back into the business. If there's anything that has surprised me the most about the Obama administration in its first 5 months in office, it is the intensity with which the president is focusing on this. The odds of success are not good. Political capital to get there will be enormous. But the president has taken this on, and frankly, I think he's doing the right thing. Let me conclude with one last observation about al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is a deadly menace and a deadly threat. Its ideas, its narrative, are a fundamental challenge to the United States of America. But let's put it in perspective. This is, after all, a small band of outlaws on the run, with virtually every intelligence service in the world chasing them. This is not Nazi Germany. This is not Imperial Japan. This is not the Soviet Union. This is an enemy we can defeat if we pursue wise policies with persistence and use smart efforts to get there. And I hope we can do it in a reasonable period of time. Thank you for your attention. I look forward to your questions.
Mr. Rydell, in your recent analysis paper that you and some of your colleagues at Brookings did, Which Path to Persia, you laid out a number of policy options, diplomatic options, military options that ranged from invasion of Iran to airstrikes to allowing or encouraging an Israeli military strike, containment, various options for regime change. We've seen that President Obama is being very cautious about openly supporting the protests that are now going on in Iran because he says of the troubled history of U.S.-Iranian relations. Brookings Institution has been very careful not to take a position on all these various options. But with all those caveats, which of the options hold, in your view, the greatest opportunities for success, and which pose the greatest risks?
A tough question. I think the place to start is to define what you think success would look like. I think we have to be realistic about Iran. Iran is a nuclear weapons capable state today. They are. They know how to spin centrifuges. They know how to put the bomb together. They know how to mate it to a delivery system. Picking as success Iran not having the capability to build nuclear weapons is a strategy which is doomed to failure because it's already failed. The technological genie is out of the bottle. I think a reasonable place to stop Iran, though, is what we used to call one screwdriver short in South Asia. Certainly short of testing and short of serial production of nuclear weapons. I think that's a success that we can get to. To get there, I think the best approach is what we call in the new Brookings book, which I bring to your attention, which you were nice enough to mention, a strategy of persuasion. Everybody else calls it engagement, but we decided to call it persuasion, which is a combination of incentives and disincentives built around the notion of talking to them with no preconditions. I think that's the right approach as long as we're realistic about where we're going to end up. I think we need Plan B because we may not convince Iran to stop short of nuclear testing. If you were an Iranian leader, whether that leader was a Shah or an Ayatollah, you would want nuclear weapons. Of course you would. Look at the neighborhood you live in. It's filled with people with nuclear weapons who act in a less than entirely rational way. You would want to have them too. So I think our chances of persuading them are less than 50-50. And we need a backup plan. And that backup plan ought to be a commitment to provide a nuclear umbrella to our friends and partners in the region so that they know that Iran will face American nuclear retaliation if the Iranians use a nuclear weapon against them. Israel should get that. Saudi Arabia and the small Gulf states should get it. Turkey already has it. We're already committed to that with regards to Turkey under the NATO alliance. That's the approach that I would go for.
Which of the options carries the greatest risks?
Well, we lay out the option of invading Iran in the paper with ground forces and occupying it. Now, many of you are looking at me like I'm crazy, but we've just invaded two countries in the world, so we do have a proclivity, it seems, to do this. Invading Iran would be hard to do, but then, of course, the real question would be, what would you do with it the day after? They're not likely to spring up as Thomas Jeffersons the next morning, even if we invite them to the University of Virginia. The thought of trying to control a country of that size, three times larger than Iraq, is mind-bending. Let's put that one off the table.
Excellent talk. I have a twofold question. First of all, do you think Israel can survive the demographic and political and nuclear pressure that it's experiencing right now? And if it does collapse, do you think that it would really bring any peace to the Middle East, or would it just be the beginning of an entirely new cycle of attacks on the West?
Okay. Very good question. Let me set the stage for a minute to answer. 1968, 40 years ago, Israeli armies were outside of Damascus. Israel was in the Sinai. Israel's capacity to inflict military pain on its enemies had just been demonstrated in the 67 war in a brilliant military success. It seemed invulnerable. 2009, it's Israeli cities that are under risk of rocket attack at any time. Israel has fought two small wars in the last several years in which it did inflict pain on its enemies, but its enemies, and these weren't even Arab states, inflicted an enormous amount of pain and hardship on Israel. First, the war against Hezbollah, which led essentially to the evacuation of the northern quarter of the country, and then the war against the Hamas in Gaza, which, while not as painful for Israel, also inflicted pain on those parts of Israel clear near Gaza. So your question is a very good one. I think it can. I think Israel can survive. What it needs to do is disengage itself from the West Bank. Holding on to the West Bank does not make Israel stronger. In fact, it makes it weaker. It's eroding the strength of the country. And Israel has, at the end of the day, its own strengths. I talked about a nuclear umbrella for Israel. The first question that people should ask me about that is, why do they need a nuclear umbrella? They got 200 nuclear weapons of their own. Israel would be smart, in my judgment, to come out of the closet about its nuclear weapons. It doesn't have to say how many it has, but I think it ought to have a declaratory policy which is much clearer on this issue, because it's a useful deterrent. It's also a useful reassurance to Israelis that they're not as weak as sometimes they may think they are. I think with an agreement, and I believe an agreement is fundamentally possible between Israelis and Palestinians, and I think we pretty much know what it looks like already. Both sides know what it looks like. It can be done. The last thing I would say on this, future generations will look back and ask us, what were you waiting for? Why did you let this conflict just continue to simmer on and get worse and worse over the years? Not just because it affects our national interests, but because of the humanitarian toll it creates. In that sense, as hard as it is, I think the president is absolutely right to take this one on. And he's going to have to use political capital, and he's going to have to be pretty hard-edged about this. And we'll see if he's up to the challenge when it comes.
Bruce, nice to see you again. Thank you for your long service. You mentioned the Al-Qaeda lineup of leaders. Zawahiri, the ideologue, he's getting a little bit long in the tooth, but I guess he's there. Osama, when I see him on the television, looks like whatever disease he's carried with him for the last few years hasn't gotten any better. Zarqawi is gone, and Mullah Omar, as you point out, is a nutball without a hell of a lot of following. So my question is, what makes Al-Qaeda so strong now? They still have the issue, but why are they, as you suggest, still a global force? And is there any sign of younger people coming up to take over the reins as these old guys disappear?
Right. Unfortunately, they're not quite that old. I don't want to get into a who's older debate here, but the odds are that they'll be around for some time to come. I think there are a number of reasons why they remain so deadly. One is the mythology that they've been allowed to create, which is that they're above the law, that Osama bin Laden in particular is beyond the reach of the sheriff. We can't find him. Fact is, we don't have a clue where he is. We don't have a clue where he is. We say he's in Pakistan. And I can give you the argument why he's in Pakistan, and I think it's a compelling argument, but it's an argument. It's not based on fact. It's not based on anyone having seen him in recent times. If he wasn't an extreme Sunni jihadist, I would say he is the 21st century equivalent of a Shia imam, which has gone into occultation somewhere above the skies where he will live forever. Thankfully, he's not. We know from capturing lower level al-Qaeda operatives over a long period of time, though, that he very much and Zawahiri are running the show, that they are giving orders, and it's not just these audiovisual ones. They are giving real orders to these people. We know from their escapades in the past that they very much run the operations outside of the Middle East. For example, the 2005 attack on the London Underground. They were trained, the four terrorists were trained in Pakistan. They got their instructions from a hand holder in Pakistan, and they provided Al-Qaeda with their martyrdom videos. We know that because Al-Qaeda subsequently released them. The most dangerous plot Al-Qaeda has been involved in since September 11th, the plot in 2006 to simultaneously blow up 10 jumbo jets leaving the United Kingdom for Canada and the United States over the North Atlantic, was also hatched in Pakistan. It was controlled by an Al-Qaeda handler in Pakistan. It almost certainly was intended to take place sometime around the fifth anniversary of September 11th. It was a plot that had all the ingredients ready. The bomb, it worked. We know that. We've got the chemicals, we've put them together, and it goes boom, and it will bring down a jumbo jet. That's why you can't take this on an airplane anymore. They had the martyrs. We have some of their martyrdom videos. And they'd even selected the flights. Thanks to good work by the British intelligence services, they were able to prevent it from happening. There's every reason to believe they're today engaged in exactly that same kind of planning, and that if allowed to operate freely, sooner or later, they will do it again to the United States. The second part of your question, are they grooming a next generation? Yes, they are. But it's not really clear very much about this next generation. In addition to bin Laden and Zawahiri, the third figure who you see most often in Al-Qaeda videos is this really strange American, Abu Amriki, he's referred to. He gets on. Apparently, they think that he can appeal to you, that you will find this guy very interesting because he's an American and speaks like an American. I think most Americans just think he's a complete nutball. And he is a complete nutball. He's apparently from California, raised in a... that's my check whether the audience is listening moment, and it works every time. He's born into a very Zionist Jewish family and apparently had some kind of conversion. But he's on Al-Qaeda's TV screens constantly. I don't think he's a serious person to take the organization over. They are grooming other people, but they keep them very much behind the scenes right now.
You partially commented on this already, but in September, Peter Bergen of CNN was here to give a forum, and he made the assessment that it's unlikely that Al-Qaeda can attack the United States in the next 5 years, citing that there's no evidence of sleeper cells in the U.S., that it's more difficult to get into the country, and that Muslim Americans do not resonate with the message of Al-Qaeda. What do you make of this assessment, particularly the reasons that he gives for this assessment?
I think that that what you just outlined is all true. It is harder to get into this country. 15 Saudi young men showing up to get visas in Jeddah and Riyadh, one way to do flight training in the United States, had better be turned down, or we are in a deep load of trouble. We have improved our defenses. There's no question about it. But I differ in this point, because I think we have a pretty good idea what Al-Qaeda has in mind if it can mount the next raid on the United States. And that is to use Muslim diaspora individuals who have British or French or Belgian passports. They know they're not likely to recruit American Muslims. There's no group of disaffected American Muslims who find the Al-Qaeda narrative appealing. But there are, in the very large Pakistani and Bangladeshi communities in the United Kingdom, but also in Norway and other places, sizable disenfranchised minorities to whom the Al-Qaeda narrative is very, very appealing because they feel discriminated against every day where they live, more than their counterparts back in Pakistan, in fact.
That's how they plan to attack. And the unfortunate news is that unlike those 15 Saudis, who I don't think will get a visa, a British citizen of Pakistani origin has Her Majesty's government passport. And he or she will sail through Dulles Airport just as quickly as you do. There's no grounds not for them to get through. The August 2006 plot, which I described, also tells us something else. For whatever reason, Al-Qaeda continues to be determined to attack the very hardest target, the transportation network. This is the thing that we have hardened the most, airline security. We've taken extraordinary measures, and everyone who flies knows what those are. And yet they seem determined to go back against that target. This is a feature of Al-Qaeda. Once they attack a target, once they select a target, they go after it over and over and over again. That's why I would advise you not to travel through Los Angeles International Airport.
I would like to switch gears, if I could.
Surely.
You've made a very compelling argument about what Al-Qaeda is doing and what your conclusions are. And you're working with the Obama administration to help move things along. The problem I see is the American people. We do not seem to have the same dedication or the same interest in trying to find Al-Qaeda and do something about it. You've written a very good book that's readable in size, much like Randy Pausch's last lecture. But it's not getting out. It should be number one on the bestseller list for nonfiction, not because you want to get rich, but because what it has to say. Now, you might want to get rich, I appreciate that. But anyway, my question is, what do we need to do to get the message out to the American people in a way in which they will understand and become part of the solution rather than part of the problem?
Well, my first reaction has to be from your lips to his ears with regard to sales. Although I should tell you that as a Brookings scholar, I don't make a penny on the sale of the book, so sells you something about my negotiating skills, too. There's a delicate line here between fear-mongering and creating panic, which we don't want to do and we don't need to do. As I said, this is an enemy that has serious and profound weaknesses, and we shouldn't build them into 10 feet tall. They're basically a bunch of murderers who have a very warped ideological argument. On the other hand, you're right. We've got to take them seriously. If there is another attack on this country akin to September 11th, and it doesn't need to be the destruction of the two largest buildings in New York City. There are a lot of other things that Al-Qaeda could do that would be quite unpleasant at best and maybe even devastating. You know, replicating on the New York City subway system or on BART in San Francisco, what they've done in Mumbai, what they've done in Madrid and London would be very serious threats. And I think, unfortunately, the national psychological reaction to it would be very unsettling. I mean, we were knocked off track very badly by September 11th. And if we had another one after all these years, it could be very unsettling. So I think the president and the administration has to play a delicate line here between being honest, making sure the story gets out. I think, you know, the president did that in his March 27th speech about why we're in Afghanistan and Pakistan. He did it again in Cairo. In Cairo, he took on the myth that the Mossad was responsible for 9/11. It's delicate. I don't know how much. Plus, let's be frank. We're now competing with some other pretty big issues for the attention of the American people. And it's an attention span that's hard to get. I think the administration just has to keep reminding people that this threat is still there and it's still deadly.
I wonder how credible are nuclear umbrella protection for our friends in the Mideast would be. I question whether we would really say strike back at Tehran with nuclear weapons if they did make an attack on Israel or anyone else in the area.
It's a good question, and a lot of people in the region ask that question. We do, however, have a track record. We have provided a nuclear umbrella to Western Europe, Japan, for some 60 years. And even pretty deadly opponents, the Soviet Union and Communist China, never questioned that. They came close, but they never questioned it. I think that American credibility in this area is still pretty strong. But let me take the question from another angle, too. I am not one of those who aspire to the notion that the Iranians are crazy. I think they're unpleasant. I think they have some pretty bad ideas. But I think the history of the Islamic Republic, and we now have some 30 years of dealing with the Islamic Republic, is that it is not a crazy state. When it sees that the cost of pursuing a certain policy is too high, it changes policy. Did that, for example, in the Iran-Iraq War. When the Iranians came to the conclusion the price of the war was too great, as Khomeini put it, they did something worse than drinking poison. They made a deal, not a very good one. Even during the hostage crisis, when President Carter communicated to the Iranians that putting the Americans on trial would precipitate military response, they stopped. The talk of trials halted. And they were probably closer to crazy in 1979 than they are in 2009. So my judgment, and this is a judgment, you know, I can't prove it, is that Iran is a deterrable state. It will behave like other nuclear weapon states. Unpleasant, it will be cocky, it will think it can get away with things that it can't get away with if it doesn't have nuclear weapons. But I don't think it's going to launch a nuclear attack on Israel, because it knows Israel would respond with a devastating response. And with or without a nuclear deterrent, the United States would probably respond.
But could it also, if it developed a nuclear weapon, slip that weapon to Hezbollah? And I don't know then if we could trace it back to Tehran. And then we strike Tehran with nuclear weapons. I just find it hard to believe we'd really do that.
Here again, it's a judgment call. I'm of the view that Iran sees groups like Hezbollah and Hamas as very useful assets in asymmetric warfare. But I don't think they have any delusions that they should give these guys control over something that could get them actually hit. I think that these are calculating individuals who have been very careful in how they provoke the West and Israel not to take a provocation which would lead to that kind of response. And I think even with nuclear weapons, they will behave like that. Albeit, they will be much more willing to sacrifice Lebanon and Gaza. The Iranians have been willing to fight to the last Palestinian.
Mr. Rydell, I want to thank you for an exceptionally insightful and clear presentation of the al-Qaeda threat today. One angle that you didn't cover today, I would be interested to hearing something about, was the China angle in connection with Pakistan being the epicenter here, the Chinese-Pakistan relationship, and the Chinese own problem with their own Sunni Uyghurs, and how that figures into the calculus of stopping the threat in Pakistan. Thank you.
I'm not going to get into the Uyghur arena, because I don't know anything about them and can barely pronounce the word. So if you'll pardon me, I'll stay away from that. China is absolutely critical to the whole business of Pakistan. In fact, let me spend a moment on what we need to do about Pakistan. Because we're not going to invade Pakistan either. If invading Iran seems like a lunatic idea, invading a country with between 60 and 100 nuclear weapons is a truly lunatic idea. And again, what would we do with it once we got it? We need to persuade Pakistanis that the existential threat to their freedom now comes from within, from the jihadist monster which, frankly, they helped to create, a Frankenstein that's gotten out of control. Very hard for us to do. We've provided Pakistan in the last decade with about $12 billion in assistance, and yet there is probably no country in the world in which America is more unpopular than Pakistan. Anti-Americanism is so high in Pakistan that more Pakistanis blame us for their troubles today than blame India. And anytime you're outpolling India as the bad guy in Pakistan, you've gotten yourself in trouble. So we need partners. We need partners in moving Pakistan in the right direction. China is a critical player. It's fundamentally the number one source of their military equipment, likely to be the source of any future nuclear reactors they're able to purchase. A country which, unlike us, Pakistanis regard as a reliable ally that comes through in the clutch. They don't think we're a reliable ally for a good reason. We're not. For 60 years, we've been an unreliable ally of Pakistan. Saudis, they pay for it. The UAE, they pay for it as well. We need them on board, and we need India on board. We're not going to change the future of Pakistan without addressing the question that obsesses Pakistan, especially the Pakistani army, which is India. The sliver of good news I would give you about Pakistan today is that every one of those players also doesn't want Pakistan to fail anymore. While Indians might take some satisfaction in seeing Pakistan crumble away, when they think about it for a minute, there's no satisfaction. Because if Pakistan today is the most dangerous country in the world, the epicenter of terror, with the fastest growing nuclear arsenal in the world, for you and I, the good news is they're on the other side of the globe. For Indians, they don't have that comfort. They're right next door. India needs a Pakistan that doesn't fail. And the other piece of good news, the new Indian government, which is the old Indian government, I think recognizes this very much. And that's why just the day before yesterday, Prime Minister Singh met with Pakistani President Zardari, reopened the dialogue, even though he's got to be absolutely as mad as hell over what Pakistan allowed to happen in Mumbai last November. Because Prime Minister Singh understands there is really no alternative to engagement with Pakistan.
This has been an extraordinary session, and let me close by asking if you would move up to 30,000 feet and give us sort of a long overview of how you anticipate American foreign policy will be influenced over the next several years. Will it be more by the Wilsonian neoliberals who want to spread democracy and universal rights, or more by the what's come to be thought of as the realist group that wants only to promote Americans' interests, or will it be, as it's been for the last 15 or 20 years, some mixture of those?
I think it's always a mixture, but I have I do have the insider advantage of having spent a little bit of time with the president and his senior advisors in a very intense way for 60 days. And I would say fundamentally these are realists. They are people who, Bob Gates, for example, who is pretty hard-nosed. He is not a dreamer. He is a very realistic person. The Department of Defense has discovered what we in the CIA found out when he was there, which he is willing to fire people when they don't do the right thing. He is not filled with illusions or delusions. And I think the president comes from the same mold. One of the things that impressed me most about working with Barack Obama for 60 days was the fact that he's deliberative. He doesn't make decisions in the heat of the moment. Usually when you have a meeting with him, at the end of the meeting, he gives you a hint of which direction he's going, but then he says, I'm going to think about it. I'll get back to you. When do you need an answer? I'll get back to you before then. And frankly, I like that. I like someone who's sitting on all of these problems, who's saying, you know, I think I'd like to sleep on it before I make a decision about sending 17,000 young American soldiers to Afghanistan.
We are grateful not only for Bruce Riedel's forum today, but also for his 30 plus years of service to our public. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.